across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there, we really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. So for every adult listening to this programme today, assisted dying, this story could affect every one of us. We don't want it to, but it's inevitable that quite a few people listening to this programme today could be affected by the debate and ultimately the decision in the House of Commons. I say that reminding you that the vote later today on this bill to allow assisted dying is for England and Wales. But whatever way that goes, it's going to possibly stimulate people thinking, well, if it's allowed or not allowed in England and Wales, how should it be here? So this is not detached from the situation here in Northern Ireland. Under the proposals, terminally ill adults expected to die within 6 months could seek help to end their own life. But that could only happen if two doctors and a High Court judge approve. People would need to take a lethal dose themselves, unlike in some countries where medical professionals can administer it. In Northern Ireland, a change in law would have to be discussed and debated here at Stormont in Northern Ireland. We'll speak to the DUP's Carla Lockhart about this morning. It's an important day for Westminster, but we want to speak to you, obviously. We want you to be at the heart of this morning. 030 30 80 55 55. And Big Barbara, who's a regular on the show. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, Stephen.
You've been with us for many, many years. I'm starting off the programme with you today. You have bowel cancer, Barbara, and so this is something that you will have been thinking about. So where do you where do you stand on it?
Well, Stephen, as you know, the last 5 years I've been ill, and I've had the bowel, a part of my bowel taken away and a keelhaul operation. And then I had the tumours all taken out of my left leg with cancer. And now I'm going through another stage. I was to go into the hospital there on the 15th of August. I have a tumour growing on my right-hand side. I have a cyst growing on my left-hand side. And I was to go in on the 15th of August to have a big operation. And they told me that it would be a real 5 hours on the theatre. And they said to me that with my heart, I'm high risk of dying on the table. So I just had to turn the operation down and try. I just have to try and cope with things that I have to wait now to the cancer will kill me. So I don't know what. I wholly agree of this thing. Many of the time I'm on the wee bit of depression tablets, and many of the day I sit and think, do I do myself then or do I not? You know, it goes through your mind. So I would agree for people in Northern Ireland to be allowed to be able to do their own selves then.
Well, doing your own self in, Barbara, first of all, you know, I must urge people today that if they're thinking of suicide in any way, please reach out for help. And there always is an alternative. I know we're talking here about something different. We're talking about the debate around legalising assisted dying with all the protections of a court and doctors and all of that. But if anybody is thinking of taking their own life, don't do it. Reach out to people. Seek help. bbc.co.uk/actionline is where you can find details and advice. There are there is the Samaritans and others who, there's always someone that will listen. This is different. This is about whether legislation should be changed so that if there is a terminal illness and you're predicted to have 6 months of life or less, that you would be able to find yourself help to take and end your life. Barbara?
Well, I think, Stephen, that when I get to this stage, I'm 82 now, and when I get to this age, I'm hardly able to walk. And when people look at you, they think there's nothing wrong with you. And then if I get out, I have to stop every couple of footsteps to get a breath. And I just say to my daughter all the time, I'm done. It's time I was in the box. So, I mean, that's the way you get when you're not well.
But you say that you're on depression tablets, Barbara. So would someone who has depression and you can have good days and bad days, would you be the right person, do you think, to decide with depression if you wanted to end your life? Can you see what I mean?
Yes, Stephen, I would do that. Yes, wholeheartedly, I would do
but
it.
But how would you be doing that rationally? And well, how would you know that it wasn't the depression at that time influencing your decision, something where you might have better days then in the future, your depression lifts and it's too late?
But I never have better days, Stephen, now. My health's gone down so bad that I'll never have any more. You know, I just get into stage, I can't cope.
So here's the starkest question, Barbara. And look, we've known each other a long time in terms of you've been listening to me for many, many years. If you could do it now legally, if you could go to a doctor and then a high court judge and get permission, would you do it?
Yes. Oh, yes, wholeheartedly, I would do it.
Tell me. Tell me why.
Because you get to the stage that you can't do anything. You go out, you can't breathe. And I get the pain in my chest every day. You know, it's really heartbreaking for me. And sometimes I sit in the house and cry. And I just say to myself, a week I was away. And I'm just hopefully I'll see Christmas. And after Christmas, I couldn't care less what happens to me, Stephen.
When you're saying that, would it not be better, Barbara, rather than the state helping you to die, if this bill went through in England and Wales and then it went through, something similar went through at Stormont, would it not be better, Barbara, stand back from this, that the whole motivation of the state was for you to feel loved, protected, supported, rather than the state facilitating a death for someone like you?
Well, Stephen, as I said there before, I'm 82, and to me, I've had my day. And I know people might think it's wrong, but I honestly, many's a time I thought of doing it. Many's a time. I've even said to the neighbours, no, I feel like doing myself in. And I was in hospital not so long ago, and I happened to sit in the hospital. And goodness, there was a whole outbreak over it. So there was just a simple saying. But anyway,
but listen to the listen to
happy.
But listen, Barbara, you have so much to give, don't you?
Yes, I try to give people. I'm trying to be kind to people and everything.
And you're charismatic, and you're on with me periodically. You've a lot to give.
Yes, but then you don't know, Stephen, how I feel. Sometimes when I get on with you, it lifts me a bit. You're down and you're sitting and you're down and you say, oh. And so, sometimes I just go out to the front door and come in again to let me get myself back to normal. If you know what I mean that way.
I think your call is so important this morning, and I'm so glad we've done it at the top of this programme today, because there's lots of different things that you're saying that prompts a lot of discussion. You're essentially talking, you've got cancer, it's growing within your body, but you're also talking about being down and depressed and you've had enough. And that is not what any of these governments is talking about, around Europe, around the world, when they're looking at assisted death. Assisted death is about the body, terminal illness, 6 months or less. is the proposal here in the UK. Maybe you contribute to the worries people have about the slippery slope. The slippery slope being, would this country get to a stage anytime in the future where if someone like you was saying, I'm down, I'm depressed, I've had enough, that they would help you die?
Well, I would like to think so, Stephen.
Well, would you?
Yes, I would like to think so for my own benefit, just Stephen. Nobody knows how I feel every day. And you get to the stage and you're just not coping.
But you don't think...
Now, not so long ago there, just recently. Now, I'm not going to mention any names, but a fellow went out and hung himself there, not too far from me.
Yeah, and we need to be... I'm going to stop you there because we need to be very, very careful, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
When we're, when we're talking about that.
But that's what... you had a depression.
You see... It's really interesting that you haven't talked as much this morning about your cancer and more about your state of mind. And surely it is the responsibility of every one of us to pump resource into and do everything we can and the state to do everything they can to help people with state of mind. What's the next stage of your cancer, Barbara?
Well, as I say, they wanted me to do the operation on the 15th of August, and they told me it was a big 5-hour operation, and with my heart problems, they told me I was going to die on the table. So I turned down the operation, and I'm going to have to live now to the cancer killed me.
And have they been able to reassure you? That
Look, there's no reassurance, Stephen. They just told me I'm high risk for dying on the table.
But what I'm asking you is, you're saying you're going to wait until the cancer... Your words, kills you. Have they been able to reassure you that palliative care will make that a relatively pain-free death?
Well, I don't know what will affect me, Stephen. I just, the tumour's there, and once it starts to grow, it's going to kill me. And they say, the sister, the other said, and they've actually told me that my heart will never stick the operation. I've already had heart failures. So when you get to all this stage, Dave, you know your own mind yourself. You get fed up with it all. And now I'm going to have to live to see when this tumour goes more, and then I'll die. But previous after that, if they give the go-ahead for people to die, I think I would be the first one.
You stay in touch with me. Do you hear me?
Oh, well, Stephen.
Many years have you been listening to...
Oh, Stephen,
Stephen
must be 50.
It couldn't be 50, I'd be one.
I know, but I've been listening to the station and all, you know. But I'm many, many years with you.
Well, look, stay in touch, all right?
All right, Stephen.
All right, thank you. Good morning to you. There are loads of organisations, aren't they? Marie Curie and others who are there to help. 03030805555. I actually think that was that was so stark this morning. You know, we've had these discussions around assisted dying and all of that. There's so many things that I'm now thinking in my mind about what Barbara has said there. Carla Lockhart, from the DUP. With us this morning, I began by asking Carla why this is such an important day for Westminster.
Yes, this, if voted on and approved, would bring seismic change to the United Kingdom. It would introduce assisted suicide. It would introduce the ability of a state-funded service that would end life. And that's not something that I or my party will be supporting. We obviously believe in the sanctity of life. We believe in the value of life. And that's from beginning to end. And we want our NHS to continue on the foundation on which it was built to protect and preserve life. So today we'll be speaking out and voting against this bill.
But for those people, Carla, who feel that this is so personal to each of us, and you are, of course, entitled to that decision, but what do you say to them when they have witnessed their mum or their dad in excruciating pain at the end of their life, and they don't want it to happen to them or another person they love. You can't guarantee them a pain-free death, can you?
Well, I've been there, Stephen. I've witnessed, you know, my dad was terminally ill for 5 years, a very painful, aggressive cancer, and his faith sustained him, but certainly the health service sought to support him, care for him, comfort him, preserve his life, and he got 5 years with his family to enjoy life. Whilst the pain was difficult at times to deal with, there was palliative care, and I want our society and our NHS to invest in palliative care, because no one has to die in pain. And if we invest in that end-of-life care, we can ensure people have dignity in death right until the end, and that their family can be with them, and that they can care for them and support them in those end times. So I believe that's the debate that we should be having, not introducing a state-funded service that ends life. That is not where our society needs to be. You only have to look at the bill and the holes that is in it around the issue of coercion. It doesn't guarantee a good death. If you look at the drugs that have been used in Oregon, there's been 11% of difficulties with them. 11% of the drugs used have had difficulties with sickness, regurgitation, death. In some instances, has taken 137 hours. That's not a good death. That's being promoted. So I think it's important that we invest in our palliative care and assisting people in that very end of life.
But you can look, when you describe this as protecting life, what about protecting a good death?
But I'm explaining it's not always a good death.
Well, why don't we try to make it as good a death as possible? Is that not what this is?
That's what palliative care is about. That's about preserving someone's life and helping and supporting them right to the end of their life. We shouldn't be handing a lethal drug to someone to end their life because they're fearful of pain or fearful of that end time. We should be supporting and caring for people right until that point. So that's where end of life care and palliative care comes into play. If you look at this bill, it talks about the 6 month rule. How does anyone say that someone has 6 months to live? If I look at my own constituency, I have two constituents, one of which was given 3 months to live. 27 years later, she is still alive and has enjoyed so much time with her family, her children, her grandchildren. I have another gentleman who was given 4.5 months to live, or 5 months to live, and he 4.5 years later is still alive. We need to get back to life-affirming laws in this.
Those would be rare circumstances, though, wouldn't they?
It is a very difficult, and any palliative care or consultant will tell you it is a very difficult thing to predict when and how someone will die. So, why take that risk? If someone is able to have that longer and better life, they should have every opportunity to do it. Whereas this bill will force people into a cul-de-sac. It will force people to think, I'm a burden on society, I'm a burden on my family, and they will potentially progress down the route of ending their own life prematurely.
How much did your dad's experience with you influence this? We're all influenced by what happens to us in our lives, aren't we?
Yeah, personal experience certainly comes into play. But I think when you're a legislator, you have to look at the broad picture as well. And if you look at where this has been introduced right across the world, there has been a slippery slope post the introduction. So if you look at the likes of Oregon, which we are being told this actually, our laws are very similar. Or if this was passed, it would be very similar to that of Oregon. They now have broadened the interpretation of a terminal illness. Now, they haven't done it in legislation, but they've done it via the courts and via doctors. So someone has been able to get assisted suicide for anorexia. You look at Canada. Canada has now made it available for people with mental illness.
But that is not what is being suggested within this bill, Carla. As you know, it's not being suggested. It's for someone terminally ill, predicted to have 6 months' life or less.
But if you look at each of those bills that were introduced, particularly Oregon, our laws that are being introduced today or being proposed today are very similar to that of Oregon. Oregon has now widened its scope with regards to the interpretation of terminal illness. It has changed in terms of residency requirements. So it widens, whether that be through law or through the courts and through doctors' interpretation. So, you know, it will be a slippery slope. It absolutely will be a slippery slope. And there's evidence there to say.
But it can't be a slippery slope if people can trust politicians in this country to not allow it to be. So do you not trust yourselves?
I'll absolutely trust my own judgment in this, and I certainly will be voting against it, as I've said. But if you look at every other country where this has been introduced, it has been a slippery slope. So, as I said to you, Oregon, which our laws are going to be very similar if passed today, there's been a slippery slope. So the tightest regulations and legal framework will not change that slippery slope scenario, particularly where you have courts and where you have doctors and where you have personal interpretation of issues. So, you know, there will be a slippery slope.
But look, where you have courts, finally, where you have courts and you have doctors, and you're describing a slippery slope as an interpretation of more and more people are able to choose to die with the courts and the doctors in place. Why is that a bad thing if that's about free choice? And if the law changes to continue to allow more and more people dying, it's them choosing that with the protection of their doctors and the courts.
But the safeguards in this bill, you know, we're told this is about terminal illness. We're told that this is about, you know, excruciating pain. All of a sudden it becomes about people being a burden on society. So if you look again, I'm sorry for referring to it again, but Oregon, 48% of people have noted on their notes that they feel they are a burden. You know, and that they was part of the reason as to why they chose to end their life. We do not want to create a society or an environment that promotes that or allows that. And sadly, if we see this law introduced, we will very quickly see it broadened out, and it will allow for such circumstances.
Okay. Carla, thanks very much indeed. Thanks for talking to us this morning. Thank you.
Thanks.
Really important today that we here at BBC Northern Ireland hear your personal experiences about this. Really, really important, as well as the elected representatives like Carla and others. 0303 80 55 55 is the number to call. We'll take the news a little bit early this morning and then we'll come back to your calls. Anne, good morning, Anne.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Just listening to your discussion this morning about assisted dying, this is something I feel very strongly about. You know, our hospice and palliative care is disgraceful. You know, we haven't got enough contribution from the government. We are relying on charities like Marie Curie. And, you know, I've heard it said so often, nobody should die in pain. Well, they are dying in pain. You know, Marie Curie nurses can only do what they can do.
And look, there's a lot of feedback, isn't there, about Marie Curie and others about the brilliant job that they do, to be fair.
They're wonderful. But the fact remains that if somebody is in terrible pain and they're on the road to dying, they need a district nurse or a doctor to come and give an injection. They're not always available. You know, it is. I get so frustrated when I hear that statement, nobody should die in pain. I really do. And, you know, not everyone is lucky enough to have a loving family that will look after them at the end of life. Some people live alone, and even people with families, as I said before, they need a medical person to come and give an injection.
So what are you saying to me, Anne? Are you saying to me that you do not think this should become lawful, or are you saying to me we should improve palliative care? Two different things.
I think that if palliative care was improved, you know, Marie Curie and the hospice movements weren't relying on people donating. I think Stormont needs to get their act together and give these people some money. You know, nobody deserves to die in pain, but the fact is they are. They are. There are people dying in pain.
I'd like to get, and I think we need to get, a medical expert on just to tell us. Because this is why I said at the top of the show this morning, it affects every single one of us. Like, I don't, surely with morphine and other drugs, there's a lot can be done to alleviate
what I would like you to ask these medical experts, because it's my information that Marie Curie nurses are not allowed to give injections. That's my information. They need either a district nurse or a doctor. And, you know, pain relief needs to go up nearer the end. But these nurses are not always available. I know of a family friend whose mother was dying, and they had to wait 2 days to get a nurse to come out to up the pain relief. You know, and there was maybe 10 people in that room watching that lady in absolute agony, and nobody could do anything. Some of the family were actually nurses themselves, but legally they were not allowed to administer an injection.
Okay. Well, look, I don't know that, but we're learning a lot today. And thank you for your call. Martin, not your real name. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning.
Good morning.
You're 67, Stephen. Martin.
I am indeed, yes. In 1981, Stephen, I was given a diagnosis that I had 2 years to live with terminal cancer. In 1981? I had a malignant tumour removed from my bowel. And they told me and my pregnant wife in a room in the side in the city hospital that I wouldn't live any more than 2 years. So if that bill was available then, what would my decision have been to live or to accept it?
Well, of course, look, and I'm not trying to be cheeky here. This bill would propose if it was 6 months or less, so that would not have applied to you. But the principle, I understand what you're saying. You were told you 2 years to live in 1981, and what are we, 44 years later? You're still alive.
I'm still alive. But now, as regards to the bill, Stephen, I think that the bill should be passed.
Why?
Because I think,
given what's happened to you, why?
Yeah, given what's happened to me, yes. I think that people should have a choice. The individual should have a choice. There's a time when the morphine stops working. There's a time when you don't know who you are. There's a time when you can't control your bodily functions. And people should have a choice not to get to that stage if they don't want to. No one would want to. But if you have the choice to stop being in agony and having no dignity, I think that people should have.
But why?
Recently, I've been given a diagnosis that I have a disease that will kill me. Right? Now, I want that choice. Right? Whether I take it or not, I don't know. Right? On religious reasons and other things. But I think that I and other people who suffer should be given that choice.
And how would you then, if you want that choice for you, how would you then protect people less vulnerable than you, that more vulnerable than you, people who maybe don't have a family, people who are being coerced, pressurised into taking their own lives? How would you protect them?
I think that there's enough safeguards preliminarily in this bill which is being laid down today to guard against that. I think that think the fact that it takes two doctors, one that doesn't know you, and so on. I think that's a start. I think this is only the start of this bill. And I think there will be enough safeguards in place to leave people with a dignified and humane end.
I know it's something completely different, but when people were being told about the weapons of mass destruction by Tony Blair, a lot of people thought, well, there are enough safeguards in place, there is enough expertise in the security services, what they're saying must be right.
Well, I think if you're going to compare politicians to this situation... We have a situation in your show yesterday where the health service is on its knees, infrastructure costs 11 food banks, and people are arguing over flags. So anybody that's stupid enough to listen to a politician on a matter like this, and you know, it's just not... It's down to the dignity of the end of life for people.
The bill would propose that you would have to take the substance that would kill you yourself.
Yes.
Like, that's against human instinct alone, is it not?
When you are in enough pain and you can't control it, right, before it gets to the point where you lose your faculties, you should have the choice to end your life in a dignified manner. And you won't be able to do that at the very last stage.
And you said you've had some news recently, Martin. Obviously, it's up to you, but have you a short period of time left?
No, I've enough time to think about things. That's all I'm going to say about it.
Okay, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Well, look, the MP who has proposed this bill is a woman called Labour MP Kim Leadbeater. She's actually speaking in the House of Commons now.
We have a duty to do what is right to fix it. Yeah. For those who are here today or watching at home, they are dealing with the very real consequences of the failings of the current system. I will start by recounting just a few of those stories. Warwick was married to his wife Anne for nearly 40 years. She had terminal peritoneal cancer, which meant she couldn't breathe properly. She spent 4 days gasping and choking, remaining awake throughout, despite being given the maximum dose of sedatives, and eventually died of suffocation. She had begged Warwick to end her life, but as he stood over her with a pillow, he could not do what she asked, as he didn't want that to be her final memory of him. Anne had excellent palliative care, but it simply could not ease her suffering. Tim fell in love at first sight when he met his wife Louise. He proposed after just 3 days, but Louise got cancer twice, and at the end, the morphine simply could not control her pain. In desperation, she managed to smash a small glass bottle and tried to take her own life, not realising that her toddler daughter had got into bed with her. Tim found her. He says, "You get to a point where you stop praying for a miracle and start praying for mercy." Former police officer James waved his mum off as she embarked on her final trip to Dignitas. She had terminal vasculitis. James desperately wanted to accompany his mum and hold her hands during her final moments. But he knew, because of his job as a police officer, it was just not possible. Indeed, she insisted he must not go with her. So she went alone. No one to hold her hand, no proper goodbye or funeral. These are just a few examples of the heartbreaking reality and human suffering which far too many people are experiencing as a result of the status quo. And the public know this. Mr. Speaker, I've always been keen to ensure that my politics stays rooted in the world beyond Westminster. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that public opinion is very much in favour of a change in the law. Polling shows consistently that around 75% of people would like to see the legalisation of assisted dying for terminally ill, mentally competent adults. These findings are significant, but it may not be that surprising that most people believe, as I do, that we should all have the right to make the choices and decisions we want about our own bodies. And let's be clear, we are not talking about a choice between life or death. We are talking about giving dying people a choice of how to die. So, Mr. Speaker, let us examine what that choice currently looks like. I do not have a legal background, but I've always been driven by a strong sense of injustice. If I see a problem, I will do everything I can to try and solve it. Indeed, in this job, we all do that every week and every day, whether here in Parliament or in our constituencies. And when four former directors of public prosecutions, including the Prime Minister, and two former presidents of the Supreme Court, and many lawyers all agree that the law needs to change, surely, Mr Speaker, we have a duty to do something about it.
Yeah.
Intentionally helping another person to end their life is currently illegal under the Suicide Act 1961 and carries a maximum prison sentence of 14 years. This includes family and friends helping someone who is terminally ill to die, both in the UK and overseas. And existing guidance does not stop people from being investigated by the police, adding fear, guilt and further trauma to grieving families. The law is not clear.
Well, that's the Labour MP, Kim Ledbetter, who has put down this motion. Let's continue talking about it throughout the show this morning together. Thomas in Belfast. Morning, Thomas.
Hello, Stephen. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Listen, I just wanted to raise a few wee points about the assistant Darren, if you don't mind.
Yeah, of course.
Just to bring you a wee bit. My mum passed away 2 years ago with dementia, and she was in the end-of-life care home. And I basically don't want to see any family having to go through what we had to go through at the end when she was down. Nobody should have to do that. We basically had to go in to the wee room. There was absolutely no life in my mother at all. She was just lying in the bed when her condition started to deteriorate. She just, for over a month, my mother lied in the bed. She wasn't allowed any water. She wasn't allowed, couldn't eat no food. Her body was deteriorating. You could actually smell the functions of her body dying. We weren't even allowed to wet our lips with a drop of water in case you choked. So how is anybody to make that decision? A person to make that decision. It says on the law you've got to have 6 months to live and you have to make that decision.
So this wouldn't have applied to your mother?
Yeah. So why is there not in this legislation that says families, other family members, can make that decision on behalf of their loved ones?
Well, you think of the risk around that, Thomas. You think of the risk of, you know, someone, and I'm not talking about you. It's clear from the moment you're starting to talk here how much you cared about your mum. But think about the risk of, for those other people who may have families who don't love them, don't care about them, you know, are thinking more about their inheritance or money than the love for the person that is their mum or dad who's dying. And you want to give families the power to end life?
No, I would say there would have to be some sort of mechanism in place. And the like, I understand what you're saying 100%, but I'm saying the like of my mother's case and probably other families' cases where their loved one is just lying, and there's nothing there. Their loved one is just lying in the bed. There's no bodily functions whatsoever. The only thing was keeping my mum alive was her wee heart, but for over a month, she was basically dead. There was nothing else there. That I understand. I can get what you're saying. People are greedy towards money and everything else. That's all there. But with a doctor should say, look, there's nothing else there. The woman's only been kept alive with a wee heart. She's in a complete other shutdown of her body. Her whole bodily functions is shutting down. Her body is deteriorating. We can see that. We can smell that. It's a family decision. She can't make that decision herself because she's in a coma. She's not even allowed water. You want the decent thing to do is just to put her out of her misery and let her go. You want her to carry on suffering.
But it's not just your mother's misery. Part of what you're saying here is the misery for the family watching this.
Yes, nobody should ever see this, what we had to see, you know. And I understand people have seen it. What I also say is, when we were looking after my mum, we were sent to the hospital. Someone were myself and my older brother, and they brought us into a room. And when my mum was in the hospital, they said to us, if her wee heart goes again, do you want us to revive her, or do you want to let her go? And we said, no, we want you to let her go. So there was a decision made then,
yeah,
you know, in the hospitals. So I understand 100% what you're saying. There is very greedy people who look upon money and everything else, their loved ones. But there's also people who don't want to see their loved ones suffering, lying there suffering, and just dying, you know.
Horrible even discussing any of this, isn't it? It's horrible.
I don't want anybody you ever, imagine getting into a room, Stephen, imagine you get into your mum's room in that wee car home, and you can smell her body deteriorating, you know, and she's just lying there, and she can't even take water, you can't even wet her lips or nothing. How would you feel?
It would kill me.
Yep.
Yeah.
But there's nothing coming across here in England for families like that, you know. And I'm sure we weren't the only one. I'm sure there's been other family members who are going through the exact same thing, you know.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you for sharing such a personal story with me. Thank you very much indeed. All right?
All right, Tim. All right.
Morning to you. Look, it's an emotive, it's an emotional, it's a sensitive discussion, it's an upsetting discussion, isn't it? And I can see lots more of you calling us today. We'll come back to this later in the programme. 03030 80 55 55. MPs in Westminster are debating this as we speak. We have another story for you this morning, because politicians in the North West have hit out at NI Water over the state of the water and sewage infrastructure, which is delaying the building of hundreds of new social houses in Londonderry. NI Water has said major projects to upgrade the crumbling system across Northern Ireland have been sacrificed or delayed because it doesn't have the money to build them. And a developer behind one of Northern Ireland's largest housing developments in Derry has told The Nolan Show he can't build hundreds of new social homes until Northern Ireland Water builds a new pumping station in the area. 2,500 new homes on the Buncrana Road in the city were approved by planners more than 2 years ago. 800 are earmarked for much needed social housing in the city. The Department of Communities, they've already approved 45 million quid around that for the scheme. Braidwaters Group Managing Director Joe McGuinness has told The Nolan Show there will now be extensive delays to the Cashel development, which is its biggest ever housing scheme. Apex Housing has told us it was expecting the first 421 social houses to be handed over to tenants in 2030, but that date's now at risk. So let's look at this story, the implications of it. Housing in Northern Ireland. What Stormont is or isn't doing. Here's what the Northern Water official, Dr. Gary Curran, told a meeting of Derry City and Strabane District Council this week about the delay in building the pumping station.
We have planning permission in for one of the sites for the pumping station, but we have been unable to purchase the land, and we are looking at alternative sites now to try and keep that moving, and the planning will be amended accordingly. So we are doing everything that we can to come up with a solution. Indeed, we're working very closely with the developer of the houses in that area, who has been very proactive in working with us and was one of the first advocates of the stormwater offsetting process. So we have a good working relationship with him, but at the end of the day, there is completely new infrastructure that is required to be built. We need to purchase the land, we need to get the planning, and then the final designs, and that's only for the new infrastructure. Where it connects into the existing assets, we need to make sure that the impact on those existing assets does not worsen any discharges into the receiving water courses.
And Dr. Curran also spelt out the scale of the financial challenges facing NI Water.
Like a lot of other departments across Northern Ireland, funding is tight, and it's particularly tight for us. But what it means, in essence, is that we will be unable through the next 3 to 4 years of our capital programme to build out any enhancements in our wastewater infrastructure. We will focus any funding that we have on ensuring that we maintain the existing assets, that if they break, we fix them. And the management in general there is to keep things running, all the systems that we have in place, and then we will protect the clean water infrastructure to ensure that everyone has safe, clean drinking water at all times. And unfortunately, that means then that what's left over is a very, very small amount for any sort of wastewater enhancements. Indeed, we feel that as time goes on and we do less work on the wastewater infrastructure, that the maintenance, the base maintenance requirements will actually increase and eat into that even more. So it's quite a difficult picture for us to work with at the minute. We're looking at ways and means of trying to minimise the impact. But in essence, we've lost just shy of £1 billion of funding to put into that wastewater recovery programme.
Almost 50,000 people are on the housing waiting list. More than 6,000 of them are in Derry alone. Families desperately waiting for years for a place to call home. Anne-Marie Appleton is with us today. Good morning, Anne-Marie.
Good morning, Stephen.
You've been on a waiting list for 5 years.
5 years I've been on the waiting list and I'm getting no further at the minute.
Can you tell me what your circumstances are, why you need help with the home?
To be honest with you, I can't even put my finger on it. I've sent numerous letters to the house executive, from my doctor, social workers, things like that. I'm just up to my eyes. I'm just so stressed out about it, to be honest with you. It's really frustrating because I'm in temporary accommodation and I can't do anything to the house. You know, I just want somewhere permanent that I can call my own home.
You're a single parent?
Single parent with a four-year-old child, yeah.
And living in temporary accommodation, you can't call that home, right?
I can't call it home because, as I say, I can't do anything to it. My wee one's in a room, just a plain white room. As I say, I can't do anything to it. Can't put any floors down, can't paint the walls, can't do, you know, can't make things to make it homely for me and her.
And have the authorities told you how high or low on the list you are?
To be honest with you, no, they actually haven't, but I'm maxed out on points. And I want to just give a wee shout out to the councillors, Rory Farrell and Mark Durkin, who is working tirelessly for me, you know, like on behalf of me. But it's just really frustrating for me at the minute. And as I say, my wee girl's only four. I can't let her out to the street or nothing because I'm just it's on the main road then, you know, I can't. She doesn't have these facilities to play or none of that stuff.
And what you're hearing this morning is these problems with the water infrastructure that we have, that's delaying hundreds and hundreds of homes from being built.
I know, I think that's an absolute joke, to be honest with you. Like, as I say, they have the planning permission and funding, but they can't be built due to issues with Northern Ireland Water. Like, Stormont's just completely letting me and my child down and thousands of families in the similar position as well. As I say, it's not only me, it's over the whole city as well, you know.
You mentioned Mark H. Durkin, the SDLP MLA. He's with us this morning. Good morning.
Morning, Stephen. I wasn't expecting to hear that.
Well, look, she says you're doing your best and you know, praise where it's due. But there's a bigger issue here. There's a bigger ticket here, Mark, which is who's going to get a grip of this and solve it? I've been talking about issues with, you know, our water infrastructure since I was in Citybeat 20 years ago. Is anybody going to solve this?
Yes, and I mean, in more recent times on your show, we've covered the effect on the economy of the troubles of Northern Ireland Water, I suppose. The effect of the environment has been well rehearsed, and we've heard today clearly from Anne-Marie the social cost of inadequate investment in Northern Ireland Water. So, I mean, we've discussed this before. It's clear who has to get a grip on this, and it is the Minister for Infrastructure. The Northern Ireland Audit Office have done a report into Northern Ireland Water and called for an expert-led review of that organisation, how it is funded and how it functions. Now, I don't know why the Minister isn't going to give the green light to that review. He has said that the current funding model is fit for purpose. Well, if it's fit for purpose, if the funding model is fit for purpose, something else evidently isn't. If we're hearing from and of thousands of people languishing on housing waiting lists, while houses that have actually been approved can't be built, something needs to change. We need that review. I mean, following that review, it might vindicate the Minister's position. It might say the funding model is fine, but identify something else that is wrong, something else that needs to change, because something does need to change, and the do-nothing option is absolutely barmy and will end up driving costs and being even more problematic as we proceed.
Look, you're criticising...
I mean, in reference...
You're criticising the minister, Mark. You're holding the minister to account, which is what you're entitled to do. But is there not also another approach here, which is some of you lot, politicians, elected representatives, take specific building projects and see what you can get, you can do to join up with other political parties in Northern Ireland and get some type of government idea as to how to get some of these building projects across the line. And I'm I don't know this developer in Derry, but 2,500 new homes in the Pacrana Road approved by planners more than 2 years ago, 800 of them for social housing, and they can't be built.
Yeah, the planning was approved 2 years ago, but that project has been 20 years in the making. I remember discussing, debating that issue when I was in Derry City Council nearly 20 years ago. Every agency was involved, including Northern Ireland Water, from an early stage in that. And now we've got to this stage, which would indicate that over the past 2 years, since planning was approved, the cost of this pumping station has actually doubled from £7.8 million to £15 million. Now, if that doesn't identify that there's an issue either with maybe was it funding or lack of funding that prevented Northern Ireland Water getting on with the pumping station, or was it down to something else? Then we need to identify what that was and get that addressed, because if it's happening in this area, it's happening in other areas too, and it's impacting the building of houses, it's impacting the growth of the economy, and it's impacting on people and families, as we've heard from Anne-Marie there.
We heard in that clip from some of the meeting that the Northern Water official, Dr. Gary Curran, engaged in when he was talking to Derry City and Strabane Council, that they reckon they're about £1 billion short. The Department of Infrastructure have been in touch with the Nolan Show this morning about this project in Derry, the Derry housing development issue. And the Department of Infrastructure have said the following: these are operational matters for NI Water, to which the department has allocated almost £500 million this year. It is for the Northern Ireland Water Board and Chief Executive to prioritise accordingly to ensure the provision of water and wastewater services. So the infrastructure are basically saying, hold NI Water to account and hold their Chief Executive to account.
Okay, and it is an operational matter, but if a government department is giving £500 million of public money, of taxpayers' and ratepayers' money, to an organisation, surely they should be holding that organisation to account and ask them what they're doing with that money. And could it be spent better? Yes, Northern Ireland Water say they need more money. I don't dispute that at all. But we have to also ensure that the money that they do get is being spent efficiently and maximising the impact of that and the benefit of it for the economy, for the environment and for people.
Of 20 seconds, now 10 before the news, which way would you be voting in the assisted dying bill, Mark, if you were?
Well, on such an important and emotive issue, Stephen, you're not going to get me to answer that in 10.
Do you want to stay? Do you want to stay on after 10? We'll come back to you. We'll come back to you after 10. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming back to the Nolan Show this morning. 030-30-80-55-55 is the number to call. I think actually Margaret Sturken had a point there at the end of that interview. We were talking to Mark about assisted dying. We were talking to Mark about NI Water. I then pop him a question about assisted dying with about 10 seconds to go. So I don't think I was on. That was my wee poo-poo, my wee slip there with Mark. So it's such an important story that I should have given them more time to answer that question. 10 seconds ago is quite ridiculous. So sorry, Mark, about that. NI Water, the statement, the development from NI Water, the development in Derry that we've been talking about, they say is subject to planning conditions, which require a solution to downstream capacity issues before construction can proceed. The existing wastewater infrastructure in the area does not have the capacity for any further connections. Making further connections without upgrading the network may cause flooding in the area, they say. NI Water gave indicative dates to the developer of when the project would be delivered, subject to all statutory approvals being in place, successful land acquisition and the availability of funding. NI Water had to sacrifice or delay many New asset bills, including both Cosquin and Lettermore projects, in order to maintain its base maintenance investment and current service levels to customers. This was communicated to the developer in July. So we can see NI Water's position in this. The bottom line is there are hundreds and hundreds of people not getting the social homes in that area on time. There are 50,000 people sitting on a housing waiting list, and which political parties are going to grab this issue, understand how important it is, and more to the point, do something about it. 0303 80 55 55. Lots of you calling us today, actually, a whole range of different subjects. Here's another story now. A pop-up stadium in Belfast could save Northern Ireland's dreams of hosting the Euro 2028 fixtures. This is the proposal from Belfast-based construction company Zed Property. They say a modular temporary stadium would take 9 months to build. Well, why are we reading this out? I'm just speaking to them. Scott Kennedy, Managing Director of Zed Property. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Well, I'm all right, but I'm looking at this. A temporary modular stadium.
Yes, indeed.
So if it's temporary, Stephen, you build it, you spend how many millions of taxpayers' money, and then you take it down again?
Right. Okay. Let's set the stall out early. Okay? This is a sporting event, a huge sporting event that England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales are delivering. Okay? So that's the first point. The second point is modular stadium, modular buildings have been used all over the UK and all over the world. Qatar, New York Cricket, Adele, 90,000 in Munich. Ooh. It's not a new thing. I'm surprised that no one has thought about this going forward, but just in terms of modular, I want to give the listeners an idea, right? Belfast hosts an event every year. Without fail, this happens. Some people like it, some people don't. Every year, Belfast City Council erect a modular little village outside. They fill it with bars, restaurants, shops.
Where?
And they call it the Christmas Market.
Ah, the Christmas Market.
It is. Something so simple. It's a modular system. It could put up, taken down, and it's dealt with. There's no legacy. There's nobody can own it. And it just is a solution to the problem.
So are you saying that you could build this...
Hello?
Instead of building casement, are you saying you could build this if it's given the go-ahead now?
110%. We've engaged with a very technical Swiss company that do this day in, day out. This is their job. Stephen, I want to put across that people in this country and further, and whatever we call it, Northern Ireland, North of Ireland, football fans deserve this. Belfast as a whole needs this. We are the best people, the most innovative people. We have a great youth. We have great taxi drivers, restaurants, bars, hotels. We need to showcase this. We can't let this not happen.
And how much would it cost?
It is site-specific, Stephen, and we're dealing with independent stakeholders as we speak. We reckon somewhere around about 40 million. But the cost to the public would be 5 to 10, which is minuscule in what they were talking about previously. Our fear is that we don't get this. People don't get the experience this, and we lose this.
Well, come on now. That's your fear as you're presenting it. Your upside here is that 40 million. Much of that's going into your company's pocket. 20 million?
No,
30 million?
No,
like, what's
no,
the profit margin here?
Stephen, we have to align ourselves with Belfast City Council, with all the people, with everybody that it takes to deliver this. This isn't us. This will take a big team effort from people we've already gone out to and spoken to. The money, happily, can be put into grassroots sport in Northern Ireland. That goes without saying. We're just proposing we can deliver this. Why should we not? Why if we can do something, why not do it?
Well, Scott, the IFA have told the Nolan Show the following. The hosting of UEFA Euro 2028 in Belfast was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that has passed. They say our efforts are now focused solely on working with UEFA and bid partners to explore the opportunities for Northern Ireland to play a meaningful role. These discussions are ongoing. So the IFA are saying it's too late. You're saying it's not.
It's not. With the political will, there's a way. there is, Stephen, and I don't care what anybody says. The IFA and people within the IFA, and I understand this, I get it, they're licking their wounds because Caseman went ahead. We would be happy as football fans if it was going ahead. I was content. It didn't bother me. But we are not getting something now. So someone has to do a thing about it.
The Department of Communities, while the department no longer has a direct role in the Euro 2028 hosting strategy, they say the minister continues to engage with all partners to see how Northern Ireland can play a role in the tournament. So, are you due to meet Gordon Lyons, the minister?
I am indeed.
When?
I have a meeting on Monday at Parliament Buildings.
Well, so what are you going to be saying to Minister Lyons?
To Minister Lyons, I'm just going to show him how the stadium can be delivered and how, with his will and the will of all the politicians, this isn't just Minister Lyons, this is Belfast City Council, this is councillors, this is everybody, this can still be delivered. And that has to happen for Belfast.
So you are publicly issuing it, I don't want to put words in your mouth, you're challenging the IFA, are you? When they're saying this is over.
Listen, we need the IFA's support to rectify this. Out of the bid that was, you know, Stephen, was rejected, you know, or let down. And I get it. These people are angry. I get it. But at the same time, you know, the biggest failure is the biggest driver to success. And the expertise the IFA have with dealing with UEFA, the people that reached out to all these people, it's still there. It still can be, you know, we can put our hand up and say, listen, this didn't go ahead. But we actually, what surprises me is that there was no plan B for UEFA for Northern Ireland. That's a fact, Stephen.
Well, why are you only piping up now rather than when they were still deciding it?
Simply because I thought Caseman was going ahead. And I was happy for that to happen, as long as we were getting European Cup football. That door was firmly closed. So let's come up. We are, you know, the companies we have in Northern Ireland get on planes every week, boats, to go and build other cities. This is a very simple process that can be delivered. It's not a permanent structure. The planning requirements aren't as much. We can deliver this.
UEFA, they've issued a statement as well. UEFA had decided, this is after they were told the Caseman would not be built for Euro 2028. UEFA say they then decided that the tournament will be organised for the other nine stadia, which were already part of the winning bid.
We are
currently working with
again.
The UK and Ireland 2028 partnership to review the allocation of matches originally considered for Caseman Park to other planned tournament stadia.
Yet again, we miss out. Is that acceptable? It's not to me, Stephen. And this, another route has not been explored. That is the problem here. That's what we're trying to address. We're looking for a solution to a specific problem. Can it be solved? Yes, it can. There are smarter people than me out there.
So what's your company's heritage? How much could we trust your company here? What have you done in the past? Have you built any £40 million stadiums ever?
Well, Steve, I worked in some of the best companies that Northern Ireland have to offer. And I've applied my trade in the UK for these companies. McAleer & Rush.
Okay.
Worked for McAleer & Rush. But not only Gilbert Ash, you've Lagans. I built apartment blocks for them in London. So big, heavy civils. You know, I think the GDV on the two schemes I built for McAleer & Rush was £220 million. But this will require an effort by other partners we bring in, utility companies, H&J Morton, Power. You know, we will be using local companies, Flynn Construction, all these people that are already here. This is not a hard problem to solve. We just need the political will, and it will happen.
And have you got, Scott, to the stage of checking whether this pop-up stadium would be UEFA compliant?
Yes, we have. We have. There are stadiums currently being built for football clubs, for football events. I'm trying to think of the Segoria. There are 25, 26, 26, 27 football season. Until their new stadium is built, they're taking a 30,000 temporary stadium to house all their matches going forward. And, you know, Stephen, we have to, and this is a very simple, simple thing to solve. It can be done.
But if
there's
I'm,
specific companies out there that do this day in, day out.
If I'm sounding confused this morning,
yeah.
it's for this reason. Mm-hmm. You're presenting this as something that is tried and tested, and therefore mm-hmm. such an obvious idea.
Mm-hmm.
Even yeah. I can't believe that nobody thought about this in Northern Ireland.
Stephen,
in Stormont, etc., etc. They must have discounted this for a reason. It's impossible, surely, for them not to have thought about this if it is as tried and tested as you're suggesting. It's just impossible.
Stephen, I got a letter from a lad in London yesterday. He had written to the bid committee asking them about had they gone down an alternative route for this. Yeah? No reply. No reply. Zero. You know, sometimes something so simple is missed. This was caught up in the whole delivery of Caseland. This was caught up. It all got, you know, and I understand people were striving for a specific goal and then it was ripped out from underneath them. I get it. I'm not trying to, you know, rain on their parade. But sometimes to think just outside the box a little is acceptable. And guess what? There is a solution, Stephen. And I'm going to take that to the minister and say, this is what we do. We've already had our third round of conversations and they're working up the solution for us in Switzerland. This is happening.
So tell
me, if there's a will to bring it forward, we will.
So give me those examples again of where this has already happened, the type of scale that has already been built in some stadia.
Right, the Qatar World Cup, Stephen. Yeah?
Yeah.
There was a cricket World Cup in New York. There was...
Sorry, this was done for the Qatar World Cup?
Yes, of course it was. And it was done, these stadiums are green, they're carbon neutral. This is the whole drive of the economy, is to get onto this. These are reusable stadiums. They already exist. You know, the one in Qatar, we've reached out to them and we're hoping they come back. But we are currently speaking to a company in Switzerland that have two available. Two sitting, ready to go, at a moment's notice.
But...
I know, Stephen. I get it. I get it. No one has explored this. That's my point. Why? That's my question as well. But with asking that question, before I came to the answer, I went and found a solution. It's that simple.
Well, help me understand this. I understand what modular is. Modular.
Yeah.
I understand that. You're building it, aren't you, in already pre-made pieces. Is that a simplistic
yes.
way of,
yes,
of describing what modular means? So I understand
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Once it's up, why are you saying it would be temporary? Why not leave it up?
Right, okay. It is a temporary stadium. It's there to be an event. You have to require it to be up 1 year prior. So the stadium will be there in 2028 from 2027, okay? So that can be used for concerts, football events, rugby events. The GAA can use it for Ulster finals. I welcome that. Anybody can have it. Anybody wants it. You can hold... Stephen, your 60th will be a big event. Maybe around that time you might think of having it there. But, you know
but
what
why
I mean?
Would you, sorry, I'm not understanding the answer to the question. Once this stadium is up...
Yes.
Why would you not leave it up? Because there's a cost of taking it back down again.
No, that's all in the cost. The cost.
But why not
delivered.
Leave it up? Explain to me why you wouldn't leave a modular pop-up up. Pop it up and leave it up. Why not?
Stephen, wouldn't it be great if we could? The problem is they have a shorter lifespan. And the reason they're, you know, the cost of benefit, you might as well go for a larger permanent stadium. And we've had three cracks at that. We've had Mays Bids, we've had, you know, Windsor Park. Ideally, the Football Association should be looking at them saying, you know, we should have left the provision at Windsor to make this bigger. You know, this was all put on Casement's front door. And the GAA are a great company, a great outfit, great people that deliver Gaelic football and hurling to the communities. And, you know, they deserve the best stadium that they can have. But I think this whole pressure of the Euros didn't help and blew it out of the water. I think they should be left alone to have the best stadium they can build for themselves.
I'm just looking. I'm checking you out while we're speaking to you.
I want to have. I went to school with you, Stephen. I was a year younger than you.
Oh.
I remember a lad telling us that he was going to take over radio.
Really?
I do.
Did I say that in school?
At school, you stood with Lorraine. I think she was the librarian at the time. We're outside the Sixth Form Centre.
Uh-huh.
And you said about... you know, about radio and how you were getting into it. You know, there was a chuckle and a laugh. And, you know, Lorraine said, I can remember Lorraine turning around to us and saying, he will make it. He will make it. So there you go.
My goodness. Oh, that's a nice, I can't remember that, but whoa, that's diverted my attention for a second. Look, I'm checking you out as we're speaking to you in terms of your bona fides of what you were saying about Qatar. I can see it here. The pop-up stadium, 974. That's a reference to a number of shipping containers used in the venue's construction.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there were 40-odd thousand people.
Absolutely.
44,000 capacity stadium.
It's still sitting empty, Stephen. And we have reached out to them. The difference is our building control and our safety standards within Europe, the stadium could come under question. And rather than go down that route and delay anything, the delays that people have taken now, we don't have time. I just want to say, there's a plug and play. This fits. This works. Put our hand up. We can deliver. And we want it back. We may have to, I don't know, I may have to go with my head laden, you know, and beg and borrow. But if it means the football fans of this country, the people of this area, everybody in the community benefit, well, then I'm prepared to do it.
Well, listen, will you do this for me?
Yes, Stephen.
When you speak to Minister Lyons, when is it? Monday?
Monday.
Are you coming on the big show on Tuesday morning to tell us how you get on?
Stephen, I hope the big show is the platform for us to get the biggest show in football for your listeners.
Right.
That's what I hope.
So are you coming on Tuesday to tell us how you got on with Lyons?
I will indeed.
Thank you very much. Scott, thank you. It's interesting. Couldn't be that tried, tested, simple, could it? Couldn't be. Let's see what Minister Lyons and our Minister Lyons and Mr. Kennedy gets on. 030 30 80 55 55. Look, MPs, as you know, we led the story this morning. We've been talking about it all week. But MPs, today, it's today, that it's right now that they're debating the bill which would allow assisted dying in England and Wales if it is the first stage of this ultimately being supported. Gavin Walker is from My Death, My Decision NI. Morning to you, Gavin.
Morning, Stephen.
So that bill applies only to England and Wales, but obviously it prompts a discussion here in Northern Ireland about what we should be doing, and the title of your organisation gives it away in terms of how you think.
Yeah, but I appreciate you taking time to speak to me. But frankly, the callers you've had on this morning, Barbara and Anne and Martin, have really done the job already. I think they've explained exactly why it's important that we should have a bill like this. And we should be able to give people who are at the end of their life and facing difficult decisions, choices in how they actually conclude their life.
But you see, so Gavin, the reason why those callers were so important is because while those people supported assisted dying, they opened up questions around it. For example, Barbara was saying that she's depressed and that might contribute to her decision. Is that not dangerous?
Well, I think anybody who's got a terminal illness who's not a little bit depressed would be unusual. But no, I don't think it's dangerous. I think that the numbers of safeguards that are in the bill itself, the numbers of times that people are asked before they actually get to the stage of ingesting the drugs to actually end their life, and the fact that they have to do it themselves. There are a lot of questions there they'd be asking themselves the whole way through. I think we could all accept that if you get to the stage where you're prepared to drink something that you know is going to be the last thing you ever drink, that you're going to be very clear that's exactly what you want to do.
So, Gavin, where's the protection? I know there's a High Court judge. I know that two doctors would have to would have to look at this as well. It's England and Wales only at the moment that's been talked about. But where's, you know, families can be manipulative. Families can coerce other members of families. And there is a significant vulnerability there, isn't there?
Stephen, you can have a look and see, but there is, in the 40, 50 years that assisted dying has been available across Europe and the world, there is not one report of coercion that's been taken through the courts at all. So I'm not to say that there wouldn't be some small amounts of family coercion that they happen at the moment. I mean, there's no protections at the moment. Within the bill, there's actually quite a few levels of protection against coercion. So it's not possible to take that out of society, but it's certainly possible to legislate for it and to try and make it as minimal as possible. But in the end, this is really a decision that somebody takes. And I think we really have to remember the person at the middle of this is the person who's had the terminal illness diagnosis, and really trying to work with them and what it is that they want and what works best for them. I think the bill that they're looking at Westminster at the moment is a great start. It works for England and Wales. We need to now start the conversation over here. And I think because people like the callers you've had this morning have stories to tell, we need to find some way to hear them. And a citizens' assembly here would be the perfect way of doing that, for people from the community to take evidence, listen to the community. We're compassionate people and we want to be having compassionate laws. From the citizens' assembly, they could put forward a report to the assembly itself. They could then debate it and move forward. But I think it's a difficult one for politicians to grasp. I understand that. Our MLAs are scared of the issue, I'd suggest, because we're the only people across the United Kingdom who aren't having a discussion. Everywhere else, they're dealing with this, they're grappling with it, and they're coping with it. So we deserve to have that same conversation.
Well, Northern Irish MPs are contributing to the Westminster debate. Some of them have done it within the last few minutes, I'm told. How soon after someone is given, let's say you're given a late diagnosis and you're told you have 6 months or less to live right now, like, it must be so profoundly shocking to your core, surprise information sometimes like that. Can you ever be in any state of mind to make a rational decision in that state of shock?
Well, I think it would be very difficult, but I suspect you'd be already living with the terminal illness.
Yeah, but what if you're not?
Well, that gets very difficult. Everything becomes very immediate. And you have to just take time to try and think through exactly what's right for you. Look, lots of people who are at that stage would have no interest in having an assisted death. They'd be quite happy to have the palliative care. And our palliative care, when it's available, is brilliant. But as we've discussed already, it's scandalous that it's not being fully funded, and that needs to be looked at as well. But some people will decide, yes, I would like to have an assisted death, or at least have access to it. It's more like a license, really. So they go through the application, they would have that available to them should they choose to use it. They have no obligation to use it. So there'll be very few people who would apply for it, and even fewer would actually use it. Yeah.
Gavin, nice to talk to you this morning. Thank you very much indeed. That's Gavin Walker from My Death, My Decision. And the vote is today in Parliament. Oh, it is Friday. I'm on 5 Live tonight at 10 o'clock. Don't even know what day of the week it is, but I'll see you later tonight. Thanks for your company this week.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.